Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. As you may know, for a long time, I used to say that my goal at the library was to make the lions roar. Well, we've changed our motto. Now it is Expect Wasabi. And we've had some wasabi already this year. We've had Bernard-Henri Lévy with Slavoj Žižek, or should I say against Slavoj Žižek. We've had James Wood, Daniel Mendelssohn, with Pico Iyer, Robert Badinter, and on Friday, I will have the pleasure of interviewing James McBride and Spike Lee. So to find out more about our events, I highly recommend that you join our email list. You'll find out all the other events we have. Many of them are not listed. For instance, the season this year will finish with an interview with Daniel Barenboim that I'll be conducting on the 10th of December. So do join our email list. Tonight, I highly recommend it. After the conversation, which, as I always say, lasts about as long as a psychoanalytical session, maybe if the psychoanalyst isn't looking at his watch, it might be 72 minutes long, there'll be a Q&A period. We will ask you to actually write down your questions. I'll ask them to raise the light a little bit during the event. So you write down your questions as legibly as you can. Ask questions rather than make long comments, and I'll come and read them here after the event. 192 Books is our bookseller, and the books will be sold after the event. Both Man in the Dark, the new book by Paul Auster, and Voice Over, the book by Céline Curiol. It is my pleasure to welcome Céline Curiol and Paul Auster tonight. Céline Curiol's first novel, Voix sans issue, has been translated in more than a dozen languages and is just out now, released in English translation as Voice Over. It is a pleasure also to welcome back, Paul Auster. He was here to interview Chico Buarque, to pay tribute to Don Quixote, and on many other occasions. And in a sense, and this I'm not sure all of you know, Paul Auster is always here. By that I mean to say the New York Public Library houses the archives of Paul Auster, and I've often wondered if writers actually come to visit their archives. This may be a subject they could talk about, but I wonder what it must mean for a writer to come and see his papers. Paul Auster is the author of numerous books of fiction, and as I said, most recently, of Man in the Dark. But I would like to single out one work of his that I absolutely adore. And for those of you who haven't read it, I highly, highly recommend you do. It's a work of his that I think of all the time, particularly now that I have two pretty young children. It's called The Invention of Solitude. And if you haven't read it, please, please do. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of writing. Tonight's conversation will be free-floating. It will be a conversation between two writers. I see it as highly digressive and focused at the same time. Digression is, after all, the sunshine of narrative. You may know that Paul Auster has introduced Céline Curiol in some sense to an American public by highly recommending the book and writing, as it were, a preface to it. And it is, I think, quite interesting to see two writers from different continents coming together. And Paul Auster, in my mind, has always pontificated in the true literal etymological sense of the word. He's always been a pontifex, someone who builds bridges between continents. He has particularly, for some reason, been close to the French language. I am particularly interested in the conversation that will now take place between Paul Auster and Céline Curiol. Please join me in welcoming them.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Céline and I didn't know that this was the format until a little while ago, so we are going to be improvising a lot. In answer to Paul's question, I've never come to look at my archive. I think since I've been around here a long time, and most of you probably know who I am, and Celine has not been around here so long, I think I would like to begin by asking her a few questions, just about her background. And you should know that for the past 10 years or so, she's mainly been living in New York City, with a few exceptions, a few interruptions. So I want to ask her, first of all, what brought you to New York?
Okay. I came to New York in 97, so it's almost 11 years. And I came because I fell in love with an American boy.
Good reasons.
So, and also because I had for a long time, you know, the dream of living here. And I had come once to New York, and I really was completely fascinated by the city. So when the occasion to move here happened, I was very happy to come. And first I thought I was going to stay for 2 months or so, and then it just extended into 11 years. So
11 years, doing all kinds of work, largely journalism for French radio. Right. Newspapers. You worked at the UN,
yes.
Also.
Yes.
UN Radio.
Yeah.
So a lot of things here. All right. I think people should know also how we got to know each other. I mean, how did this happen? I mean, why are we sitting here on this podium together tonight?
Okay. Okay. Well, it's I'll tell my end of the story maybe. I read Paul's work when I was 14 years old, so that was a little while ago. and the first book I read was The Country of Last Things. And when I came to New York, I was living in Brooklyn, and one day I saw Paul walking down the street, and I was very impressed, and I thought, whoa. You know, then I thought I have to write him a letter or do something. And because at the time I had started writing, even though it wasn't very serious, maybe. And so I wrote a letter, but I think it got lost or something. I don't know. And then your assistant wrote to me and say, well, you know, he's very busy, but if you ever walk by him in the street again, just talk to him. And of course, after that, you know, it never happened again. So, and then, well, maybe you should say the...
Well, I don't want to get the story wrong, but I think you wrote again, and I think you might have sent me some of your earliest works, which I thought were very promising. And, I mean, you were very young then, in your early 20s. And there was an event that was taking place in New York.
Right.
At the French consulate.
Yes.
Right? I was getting a medal from the French government.
Right.
And I said, well, why don't you just come? Was that it?
No.
It wasn't it. Okay.
I came because I got invited because I was, part of the French community. And so then I got invited. And my friend was saying, oh, go talk to Paul Auster. Anyway.
So that's where we met.
Yes.
I remember that well. And that was probably 8 or 9, 10 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, it was 10 years ago.
10 years ago. Yeah. All right, so then I should tell you, too, that Celine studied not literature, as one might imagine for a writer. She's now working and almost finished with her third novel, by the way. This first one, published in English, was published in French, I think in 05, if I'm not mistaken, in 05. And so there's another one out and another one on the way. But... Miss Curiel studied engineering in the top engineering school of France. And I just wonder how you made the shift from science into literature.
Okay. I think it happened gradually, and I always, you know, in France it's very separated if you're, you know, good in science in school. You're not supposed to be good at literature or philosophy, or it's very much separated. And so I was good in science, and I was very bad in French. And so naturally, I was pushed toward engineering. So that's what I studied. And then, you know, I had always written, but it was for me. And then slowly, by living here, where the culture is much more open, like it wouldn't be perceived as something strange if, you know, if you are an engineer and you want to do something else. In France, it's almost like, why would you do something else? Because you could have a good job. And so by living here, I think I got a sense that I could, you know, be something else. And I just kept writing little short stories and slowly gained the confidence to do it.
Well, I remember once you told me a very interesting story about your engineering school and the trip that you made abroad with the rest of your classmates, which was probably, you said to me then, the last straw, when you understood you didn't want to be an engineer. Can you tell that story a little
bit? Okay. Well, I tried to make it short. I was part of a school in France that was paid by the defense ministry in France, and we were sent to South Africa for a trip that was supposed to be a visit to different companies, and we ended up visiting arm factories. And everybody thought, you know, we were there and we were, you know, people were showing us different weapons, and because they thought we were presented as future weapon engineers that would potentially buy weapons to South Africa 10 years later. And I was among, I don't know, 100 students, and it seems perfectly normal for almost everyone. And I just, for me, it was very shocking because we were trying, you know, char d'assaut, I forgot, tanks and, you know, all kind of things.
You had to get into tanks and drive around in them.
You know, I had a sense that I was part of some kind of system that I didn't want to be part of. And it was one of the reasons that I decided, not that every engineer is like this, but I just thought I wanted something more independent where I could have my opinion without feeling like I have to conform to, you know, whatever is being said around me.
Right. So by the time you came to the U.S., engineering was behind you then. You decided you didn't want to do it.
Yes.
And I think I remember that your first job in New York was working in a restaurant. Is that so?
Yes, that was true.
Yeah.
That was true.
So then you built yourself up.
Yes, and then I, you know, did more writing, but I have my little questions as well.
Okay, all right.
No, I was, you know, one of the common things, you know, we have is that we both lived in a foreign country in our 20s. I mean, you lived in France for 4 years, 5 years?
Three and a half.
Yeah. Okay, so, but still. And I was wondering how you think it influenced. Did it influence you to become a writer in any way, or did it influence the way you look at literature, or, you know, in the same way that for me being in America, in the American culture was a liberating thing?
Well, I think my reasons for going were probably a little different from yours. When I went to Paris, it was very early 1971, January or February. So the war in Vietnam was going on at full tilt. I had flunked the draft, so I wasn't going to be drafted into the army. And I realized that after an undergraduate career of politics. You know, I went to Columbia University, where everything was in upheaval for at least the last 2 years I was there. I felt a need to get away from the noise of the United States at that time, because I already was committed to becoming a writer, but I didn't really know if I had the stuff it took to become a writer. And I thought by leaving, I might get a different perspective on myself and on my country. And I think what happened to me in France was that during those 3.5 years, I understood that I was going to be a writer, that this was the only thing I wanted to do and the only thing I could do.
How did, because of the people you met there? Or because,
no, just no? The fact that I was working so hard, because I was frankly quite distracted here as a young student. There was so much going on, and I never really spent the time on my work that I should have. I cared about it, I was committed to it, but too many other things were happening as well. What I took away from those years in France, particularly in Paris, because I spent 1 year in the country, was the kindness of older poets toward younger poets in Paris, in ways that I had never quite experienced in the United States.
Hmm.
People like Jacques Dupin, André Dubuchet, and Edmond Jabès, they literally looked after me.
Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons why, learning from their generosity, I feel it is an obligation of older writers to look after younger writers.
Right.
And I think that's why I wanted to help your book. It's something that was taught to me,
right,
but particularly in France, not in the United States.
It's interesting because for me, coming to New York, 20 years later, I had a sense that American writers, which were much kinder than, you know, the French intellectuals, you know, that I didn't feel like I could, you know, if you weren't part of, you know, a certain group, you'd never be acknowledged as a writer. And it's true that when I met you, you were very welcoming and paying attention to, you know, other writers or young writers. But it's funny, I got the impression of that here, and you got that impression.
I know, but you see, I think it could be that we're both right and we're both wrong. Because I understand what you mean about the severity and the clubbiness of the French intellectual elite, so to speak, and these writers' groups. I just happened to be lucky in the people that I got to know. They were really special.
Right.
They were people of great, how shall I put it, solidarity. It's not true of the French necessarily. American writers, I think, run the gamut from the competitive to the generous. And
is there anything that those poets told you at the time that you remember as a kind of guidance or something, that some advice they might have given you?
It was all by example. There was nothing anyone ever said. But I can remember very well a moment when I was expecting a check. I had done some work, but the money hadn't come yet. And I was very strapped for cash. And I was with Jacques Dupin, who's a poet I translated, you see, as a very young person. And he's 20 years older than I am, but we became very good friends. And he kind of knew about my difficulties, and I remember we're having lunch one day, and he started paying the bill for the lunch, and he had all this money in his wallet. He said, you know, I just got some money. J'ai touché l'argent récemment. And he just started giving me money. And I said, don't, you know, I can't take it. He said, just take it. Don't worry about it. It's just simply not important to me.
Right.
That's the way he was. And I realized later that he worked at the Gallery Mag, which was the very famous gallery then. And they showed all the great painters and sculptors, I mean, Miro and Chagall and Calder and Giacometti, and they were doing a series of books, monographs on the artists in the gallery. And there was some vague possibility of a translation deal with some English publisher. So he started hiring me to translate these books into English, which I did. But of course, they were never published in English. And I realized that Jacques was just making work for me so he could pay me and leave me my dignity. And
that's
without ever saying a word, because I thought it was an authentic contract. And this is the kind of generosity I'm talking about.
Yeah. That makes me think, I don't know if you will want to tell it, of the story you told me about your encounter with Beckett and the perpetual doubt of writers. I don't know if you want to tell that story,
but I think it's one
of the story that, you know, you told me that really stuck with me, and I thought, wow,
well,
this is maybe what it is to be a writer.
I know, it stuck with me too, I have to say. Well, among the people that I got to know in Paris was Joan Mitchell, the American painter, the great painter, whose reputation now, after her death, just keeps growing. And Joan was a very feisty character, but we became friends. And she knew Beckett very well. And Joan had earlier in her life been married to Barney Rossett, the publisher of Grove Press, and who published Beckett. And I don't know, I was one day, we were talking, and suddenly I mentioned how much I admired his work. And she said, do you want to meet him? And I said, of course, I'd love to meet him. And I was about 25 years old. And she said, just write him a letter and say I said so. So I wrote a little note, dear Mr. Beckett, Joan Mitchell suggested that I write to you, and would it be possible to meet? And 3 days later, he answered. And he just said, meet me at the Closerie de Lilas, such and such a day, such and such a time. So I went. More nervous, probably, than I'd ever been in my life. If I'd been going to meet Winston Churchill, I wouldn't have been as nervous as I was that day. And so we sat down, we talked. He was very kind and very engaged and wanted to know about me and so on. And at one point, he mentioned that he had just translated his first French novel into English, a book called Mercier and Cambier, which had been written in the mid-40s, but a book he didn't publish in France until 1970. And after he won the Nobel Prize, I think they were pushing him to pull things out of the drawer so they could publish more books of his. And so he published the book, and then he said, I was translating the book, and I realized it wasn't very good at all. And he said, I cut out about 25% of the French for the English. And in my naivete and enthusiasm, I said to him, why would you do such a thing? I think it's a great book. And he said, no, it's really not very good. And then we went on to talk about other things. And about 5 or 10 minutes later, he looked up and he said, you really think it's good, huh? And I said, yeah, I really think it's good. And suddenly I understood that writers don't know what they do.
They
doubt everything, and you feel terrible about everything.
But I think that's what's the most reassuring thing that I've heard from you. About, you know, what it is to be in doubt. But there is another thing that, you know, sometimes people tell you one thing and you listen to it, you don't really understand it, but it stays with you for a long time. And after years, you might understand what they've said to you in a better way. And, you know, years ago when I sent you those short stories, you said to me, what's important is the space between the sentences. And I was trying to picture what it meant at the time, you know, the space between the sentences, okay, maybe the blank, what is it? You know, then I understood, but I'd like you to explain
what I meant was how the most thrilling kind of writing is when the writer is leaping from one sentence to the other. that the next sentence is not something we're expecting to read, that maybe something is left out, and that if it's done correctly, the reader's mind can make that leap. And there's a very exhilarating sense of narration going on. And I think when I recall your earliest works, they were very densely packed. And then you see, and then they got better and better, and more interesting, more and more assured. But then, I mean, you know, you were doing a lot of things. You're writing journalism, and I think this probably helped with your prose also, just the right. fact that you had to be precise and concise. And Céline also, I should say, before she ever published the novel, wrote a very interesting guidebook to New York City for yes. a French publisher.
Right.
It was right. really quite a terrific book. So that yes. was another stage of your apprenticeship, so to speak.
Yes, because I discovered that I could write a book.
Yeah,
right. Meaning, like, more than, you know, because there is this, I had this fear about length, you know, like, you write a short story, it's 30 pages, 40 pages, but a book is very, you know, and if you're like books, you're kind of, you know, very impressed by them. So that was a good experience in the sense that I discovered that, you know.
So there I am, you know, reading your work, and then, you know, years have gone by. And suddenly, you showed me passages from this, and I felt that an enormous leap had been made, that you had finally, truly, totally come into your own. You knew exactly what you were doing and what you were trying to accomplish. And so, you know, I just wanted to know, how did you get to that point? And where did this novel come from? Do you have any idea? Can you articulate mm. this?
That's
I know it's a very difficult
yeah,
question.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. Well, I think it was maybe some kind of faith, you know, the idea that, and the idea of the character that was very, not the idea, but, I don't know how to call it, but the character that I had in my head was very clear. I couldn't put it into word, but it was like, I knew what I wanted to say. That was, I think that was, compared to before, I knew much more what I wanted to convey, maybe not to say, but to convey the emotion. And I don't know, it was face, you know, I wrote it, the way I wrote the book was I would write a certain length, but I never looked at it. So I wrote the whole book, never looking back, because I was so afraid that maybe it's very bad and I have to stop. So I was just, you know, writing it. And I don't know, maybe confidence helped.
Mm-hmm.
And
How long did it take you? Do you remember from first word to last?
I don't know, maybe 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Something like that.
I think it might be interesting at this moment, since, of course, Céline is writing in French. And what is for sale tonight is English. I think it might be interesting if we found one passage
yeah,
that
short.
Might be interesting to hear in the French, and then yes. I'll read from the English translation. Maybe we should give a little bit of the background. Our heroine here is at a train station, and she's missed the train. She was supposed to go off with a man, and the train has left. And so, here we are.
Right, so she's missed a train and she's going to take another train.
Après le douanier français, c'est une douanière britannique, impassible et rigide, qui examine la photo de sa carte d'identité et la réplique vivante qui lui correspond. Il est passé là plus tôt et l'officier l'a sans doute regardé de la même manière, avec cet air détaché et professionnel. Elle pourrait le lui décrire et obtenir l'assurance qu'il l'a précédé. « Excusez-moi, je cherche quelqu'un. Je me demandais si vous l'aviez vu passer. Il a pris le train de 9 heures. » La douanière remonte ses yeux jusqu'aux siens, sourcils froncés, visiblement étonnée que le sujet étudié ait la capacité de s'exprimer. « Il est grand. En tout cas, plus grand qu'elle, un peu plus grand. Enfin, elle n'est pas très grande, c'est vrai, mais dans la moyenne tout de même. Il est brun aussi. Pas très foncé, mais pas trop clair non plus. Il est brun comme le sont en général les bruns bruns. Il a des yeux assortis à la couleur de ses cheveux, un peu plus verts. Non pas qu'il ait du vert dans les cheveux, mais les yeux ont quelque chose de plus lumineux qu'elle attribue au vert un peu noisette. En gros, il est bel homme, bien qu'elle ne soit pas sûre qu'il le soit dans l'absolu. C'est plutôt qu'elle le trouve à son goût. Il est difficile d'expliquer son goût. Il ne doit pas être trop moche, tout de même, à cause d'Ange. Elle n'aimerait pas un gars qui n'irait pas avec elle. Il porte un costume, souvent. Mais aujourd'hui, il n'en a sans doute pas, vu qu'il ne s'agit pas d'un voyage d'affaires. Enfin, si, il est censé être en voyage d'affaires, donc il aura sûrement mis un costume pour faire illusion, ou peut-être l'a-t-il glissé dans sa valise pour être plus à l'aise. Mais de cela, elle ne peut pas être sûre.
It's so wonderful in French. And here's the English. After the French customs officer, there's a British customs officer, a stiff and expressionless woman who compares her identity card photo against the living duplicate it represents. He came through this gate earlier, and the official probably looked at him in the same way, with that air of professional detachment. She could describe him to her and be assured that he was here before. "Excuse me, I'm looking for someone. I was wondering if you saw him pass through. He took the 9 o'clock train." The customs woman slowly lifts her eyes to meet hers and frowns, visibly surprised that the subject under examination possesses the power of speech. He's tall, or at least taller than she is, a bit taller. Well, that's not to say that she's very tall. She's average. He's got brown hair, too. Not very dark, but not very light either. The kind of brown that people with brownish brown hair have. His eyes match his hair, a little greener. Not that he has any green in his hair, but there's something luminous about his eyes, which he associates with a hazelnut brownish sort of green. A good-looking guy, basically, though perhaps not in the strictest sense of the word. It's more that he's to her liking. It's hard to explain what she likes. Anyway, he can't be too bad-looking on account of Ange. Who wouldn't like a man whose looks didn't go well with hers? He often wears a suit, but probably not today, since he's not on a business trip. Although, yes, he's meant to be on a business trip, so he's bound to be wearing one to look the part. Perhaps he slipped it into his bag to feel more comfortable. But on that point, she can't say for certain.
Okay. That brings us to maybe the question of translation.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, well, my question to you is, now that you've lived in America for so long, and have mastered English so well, could you ever write in English, do you think?
I mean, I've never really tried, but I don't think I would be able to write fiction in English. I mean, I was thinking about it when you mentioned Beckett translating his own work, and For me, I reread the translation of VoiceOver and also corrected it, and it was very difficult to do. Just to, resist the temptation of changing what I was, you know, rereading. And so I think that would, you know, that's difficult. But also writing in English, for me, I can write nonfiction, but fiction, there is something about the feeling you have of a language, the sense that you can't even explain, but you know what sounds a certain way. You know, and it's not even knowledge, it's more like you feel, I mean, I'm sure maybe you can talk about it, but that you have a sense of what is a good sentence. In English, I can say what is a good sentence grammatically, I can say this is, but I wouldn't know, you know, exactly what is a good sentence.
I'm the same way. My French is good. I don't think my French is as good as your English, but I couldn't possibly write in French.
Why?
I'm just not immersed in the language deeply enough. There's so many things I don't know about it. So many little twists. I'm not in the interstices of the language. Again, I can appreciate it passively. I can read a French book in French and know that it's well written or not well written.
So you'd know that.
I can know that, yeah. But it's a passive response. I can't actively produce it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The same thing.
I mean, there are remarkable writers in the history of literature who have written in other languages,
yes,
the ones they were not born into, but it's really, in the end, quite rare.
Right. Yes. It's difficult. And about translation, I mean, we were talking earlier and we said it's impossible to translate a book. But yet, you know, translation happen, and you've done translations,
yes,
as well. So what is it? How we...
Well, I think we live off of translation. We have to have translation. Otherwise, we'd be confined to our own language. And imagine if you lived in, Denmark, and there are 5 million people there, and you couldn't read anything else.
But you, when you were translating French into English, what were you looking for? How did you have... what was important in
Well, I did two kinds of translation. This is all when I was quite young. Translation for love, which was mostly poetry. And then translation to make money, which was all prose, mostly nonfiction prose, some very bad books. And I would just crank it out, try to make the best sentences I could, and then that was about the extent of it. With the poetry, I worked very, very hard, and I think really trying to create English poems out of the French poems. And I think this kind of exercise for a young writer is very valuable, because it teaches you how to manipulate your own language, but all the pressure's off. You know, you don't have to create something, you just have to reinvent something, and it's a very big difference. And I think it's something that every young writer should do, if possible.
Well, yeah, you need two languages.
You need two languages, yes.
Right, right. So it's possible, but it's difficult. Because for me, like reading your books in French and compared to English, it's something else.
Yeah.
It's very hard for me to, you know, you write in English and that's it. I can appreciate the books in French, but it's very difficult.
When I look at my books in French or Spanish, I don't recognize my work at all. It just doesn't feel... I know the words are literally accurate, but there's something about the rhythms and the sounds that just are very different. But I do think there's a tiny little moment in your book, which I find very amusing, which is clearly, it seems to me, affected by your knowledge of English and your having lived in America. But it's only the kind of thing that someone who's not a native English speaker would be able to make a joke about. And I want to find this. I hope I can find it quickly enough.
I can find it.
You know where it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, don't mind me. Okay, that's it.
Okay.
I mean, that's just...
Okay,
end.
So... So the character is gone to a film. This passage ends with, the film was called Monster's Ball and not Monster Balls, as she'd called it when buying the tickets. Balls, the ticket clerk had pointed out, means testicles in English. She had felt ridiculous.
Okay, I sometimes, we really don't know what we're doing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you wrote... In one of, I think it's a poetry, your collected poems, this sentence, I mean, these two sentences that I kept in mind also for a long time. It was, the world is in my head, my body is in the world. And your new book, if I may borrow, I'm going to read just one, starts with, I am alone in the dark, turning the world around in my head as I struggle through another bout of insomnia, another white night in the great American wilderness. So this thing about turning the world in your head, having the world in your head, what, it's an image that comes back. I mean, what is it? Do you want?
Well, for me, we all live inside our thoughts, our perceptions of the world. I mean, the world literally is in us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to function in the world. I mean, we carry everything within. And at the same time, our bodies are within the world. And it seems to me that this paradox is what defines us as human beings. I mean, all our thoughts, all our feelings, all our perceptions are in here. And yet, we are physical matter as well.
Right.
And, you know, we get sick, we get old, we die. All these things happen to our bodies. And so it just seems to me a statement of human existence.
Could it be also a statement about reality and what is reality and the fact that we create?
That too.
And your relationship, yes. You know, you've said once before that you felt like sometimes the world wasn't, that world outside, not the one inside, wasn't real.
Well, so I think, I don't know, I'm sure I'm not the only person who's felt at times that just disconnected from what's going on around me, as if it's not real. Sometimes I've had the feeling that I don't even exist. And so sometimes also when you're working really hard on a book and you're deep into it, the outside world sometimes just kind of falls away. Mm-hmm. And you're in your imagination so much. I think that's why it's good that we can't write 24 hours a day, that we have to eat and sleep and finally reconnect with the people and things around us. Otherwise, I think we just drown inside our interiority.
But would you say that writers might have a different sense of reality, or that this perception of reality, this fracture of this moment when you feel you're not real, might be what creates the impulse to write fiction?
It's possible. Maybe writers emphasize this more. Maybe it's something they draw upon more. But my sense is that most people go through these experiences too. It's again part of being who we are.
So in Men in the Dark, there is your main character is an older man who, so what I read, he's in bed at night, he can't sleep, and he starts telling himself stories to go to sleep.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, how the book starts. And I was, this idea of telling yourself stories to keep the real world, you know, at large. What can you talk a little bit about how you came up?
Well, I thought maybe I'll read from the beginning of the book.
Okay.
Maybe just so people have a sense of what we're talking about. So this is how the book begins. This is the first 4 paragraphs of the book. I am alone in the dark, turning the world around in my head as I struggle through another bout of insomnia, another white night in the great American wilderness. Upstairs, my daughter and granddaughter are asleep in their bedrooms, each one alone as well. The 47-year-old Miriam, my only child, who has slept alone for the past 5 years, and the 23-year-old Katya, Miriam's only child, who used to sleep with a young man named Titus Small. But Titus is dead now, and Katya sleeps alone with her broken heart. Bright light, then darkness. Sun pouring down from all corners of the sky, followed by the black of night, the silent stars, the wind stirring in the branches. Such is the routine. I have been living in this house for more than a year now, ever since they released me from the hospital. Miriam insisted that I come here, and at first it was just the two of us, along with a day nurse who looked after me when Miriam was off at work. Then, 3 months later, the roof fell in on Katya, And she dropped out of film school in New York and came home to live with her mother in Vermont. His parents named him after Rembrandt's son, the little boy of the paintings, the golden-haired child in the red hat, the daydreaming pupil puzzling over his lessons, the little boy who turned into a young man ravaged by illness and who died in his 20s, just as Katya's Titus did. It's a doomed name, a name that should be banned from circulation forever. I think about Titus's death often, the horrifying story of that death, the images of that death, the pulverizing consequences of that death on my grieving granddaughter. But I don't want to go there now. I can't go there now. I have to push it as far away from me as possible. The night is still young, and as I lie here in bed looking up into the darkness, a darkness so black that the ceiling is invisible, I begin to remember the story I started last night. That's what I do when sleep refuses to come. I lie in bed and tell myself stories. They might not add up to much, but as long as I'm inside them, they prevent me from thinking about the things I would prefer to forget. Concentration can be a problem, however, and more often than not, my mind eventually drifts away from the story I'm trying to tell to the things I don't want to think about. There's nothing to be done. I fail again and again, fail more often than I succeed, but that doesn't mean I don't give it my best effort. I put him in a hole. That felt like a good start, a promising way to get things going. Put a sleeping man in a hole and then see what happens when he wakes up and tries to crawl out. I'm talking about a deep hole in the ground, 9 or 10 feet deep, dug in such a way as to form a perfect circle with sheer inner walls of dense, tightly packed earth, so hard that the surfaces have the texture of baked clay, perhaps even glass. In other words, the man in the hole will be unable to extricate himself from the hole once he opens his eyes, unless he is equipped with a set of mountaineering tools, a hammer and metal spikes, for example, or a rope to lasso a neighboring tree. But this man has no tools, and once he regains consciousness, he will quickly understand the nature of his predicament. So that's how the story begins.
Right. So in the book, there, to me, when I read it, I thought there's as much present the characters that are alive than the characters that are dead in the story. I mean, this young man.
Yes.
Also the wife of the main character. And we talked earlier about what brings us to write. I mean, what made, you know, I've asked myself often that question, why do you want to write? How did it start? Why is it just such a strong urge? And I've came to a temporary conclusion that it might be absence. It might be, you know, absence of certain people in our life that disappear because of death or other reasons that bring us to write, to try to keep something. Do you? And, you know, Paul mentioned earlier The Invention of Solitude, which was your first prose book, and that you wrote after your father died. Do you think, could you talk about that relationship?
Well, I think you're onto something here. I think it's true. I had never written a prose book before. I was 31 years old, and I'd just been writing poems, doing translations, writing essays, hoping to become a novelist someday, but not really feeling very good about it. And then my father died very suddenly, unexpectedly, and this impulse to write about him came over me. It was a tremendous force. And I sat down, it was just 2 weeks after he had died, and sort of blindly started writing. And this writing eventually turned into that book. And it was this desperate sense of trying to hold on to something before it completely disappeared. And of course, it's not a novel. But I think maybe the impulse to write novels comes from something similar, a kind of imaginary absences, or absences that are real and then somehow become in a novel, metaphorically transformed into fictional absences.
Right, into something. And in your book also, the main character think a lot about his regrets, things he should have done differently, things, you know, he might have done differently. And, I mean, I don't want to reveal maybe the end of the story, but, you know, telling himself stories also helps him.
Yes, of course, it's complicated, because I think the story that he tells is somehow an image, again, a metaphorical image of his own state of mind. And so, in a way, the story is kind of psychological exploration of what's going on inside him. So it's functioning on several levels at once.
Right. And the other thing is interesting also, I mean, people never really talk about it, but, you know, it's also a way of talking about absent people. Dedication in novels, you know, we always, I mean, most novelists, most writers dedicate their book to someone. What is it? Why? And in this case, you know, if you can talk about the dedication of this book.
Yes, this book, well, it says on the first page, for David Grossman and his wife Michal, his son Yonatan, his daughter Ruti, and in memory of Uri. Now, David Grossman, you probably know who he is. He's an Israeli novelist and writer. He's a very close friend. Someone I think is a great writer and a very great man. And his son, Uri, at the age of 22 years ago, was killed in the Israel-Lebanon war. And it really hit me hard. It was a terrible, terrible business. This little boy I had met in Israel some years before, at 20, being killed. And I think this contributed greatly to the feeling of the novel that I wrote. So it had to be for them.
And you thought about them while you were writing the book?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I've been thinking about the book. And then when this thing happened, the whole book fell into place for me. And I knew what it was going to be. It's a terrible, terrible equation, but that's true.
And do you think it might be true for other novels, that there was someone that in a way was in your mind?
Yeah, there have been times, you know, I have dedicated books to people who are dead several times, you know, for so-and-so in memory, and always thinking about that person very much while I was writing the book, and almost trying to write the book for that person, even though that person was no longer around. You know. Right. It's a kind of gift to the dead. Very strange. Well, enough about me. Let's talk about you a little bit. Céline's novel really is, I think, a remarkable piece of work, and it's a very unusual French novel, in that it tells a story, in that it has humor, as you've already witnessed, and
very good humor.
Yeah, and I should just say something about the title, I guess, first of all, because the French title, Voix sans issue, is a kind of play on words, because voix, in this case, is V-O-I-X, which means voice. But there is an expression in French, voix sans issue, V-O-I-E, which means dead end, means you can't get through.
Right.
And so it's impossible to translate it literally. And I remember when we talked about it, and finally we came up with voice over, which is different, but at least it means something
in
English.
Convey, yes,
yeah.
Some of the...
Yeah.
Yes, that was good.
Yeah. So in any case, there's several aspects of this book that really fascinate me. And one of them is the psychology of the central character. The protagonist is a young woman, never named, And we don't know exactly how old she is. We assume, I don't know, in her mid to late 20s, mm-hmm. 30 at the very outside. And she works as a loudspeaker, public address announcer at the Gare du Nord, the train station in Paris.
Right.
And Céline follows this rather enigmatic young woman through a series of quite bizarre adventures, some of them sexual, some of them not, in a Paris that is completely today's Paris. It's the new Paris. It's the Paris of...
It's at least how I perceive it.
Well, it's the multiracial Paris, the Paris of the 21st century.
Right.
I was very impressed by the sort of the interaction between her, well, the world in her head, and then her body in that world, and how they interact. And I just wonder how you stumbled upon her. I mean, was she just growing up inside you as a independent force, or was there some thing that happened that made her come alive for you?
That's a good. Well, I had this. I had two ideas. I was very much at the time. I was thinking a lot about encounters. You know, what it means to meet somebody you don't know. What happens in that moment? Even if you never see that person again, you know what you get from that moment when you know you meet somebody unknown, which to me was a reflection of the Paris I knew when I was a student, and which had seemed to disappeared over the years because people had less time, they were on their cell phones, they were on their computer or whatever. They didn't, you know, meetings, chance encounter were seemed to me, you know, a less common thing. And so I was thinking of a character that would go through a place where she would meet different people, but the meeting had to always be short, also, but still something important would happen in that moment. And also it was the idea of a character who says, you know, yes, when most people would say no. You know, you start, something happens and it's the beginning of a story, and you know, you'd say, no, I don't want to go there because it's not in your habits, because it's not what you're used to. But with that character, I wanted to see what would happen to someone. Okay, this, you know, it's like your man in the hall.
Yes.
What if you'd said, you know, yes to several things. And also there was this idea about love and obsessive love, and you know, having a character who was completely obsessed by a man to the point where, you know, everything she was doing was just a way to forget about that obsession, but this obsession would keep coming back to her. So that were basically, I think now that that were what I was trying to do with the book. But
well, I think it's a remarkably compelling book. And now that you've written another book, Permission, a completely different kind of story that takes place inside an organization, a little like the UN, which you're quite familiar with.
Yeah.
I remember Céline told me an amazing story. I think it was during the blackout of a few years ago.
Yes.
Maybe you can tell it, what happened to you in the UN. I think this is...
Okay.
Pretty interesting.
well, talking about where the idea of a book comes from. I was working at the UN. It was 2004, the blackout.
I think so.
And I was there when it happened, and I ended up being stuck in the building in the dark by myself, which was quite a strange experience. And with only a few security guards walking around, and the atmosphere of the place, you know, was very, very strange. And I think the idea of the second novel just came from that night, you know, in that strange building. You know, it's usually a building with hundreds of people.
Right.
You know,
Right. And so now, as you're coming to the end of your third novel, I mean, what changes have you discovered in yourself now over the course of these three books, as a writer, I suppose? Mm-hmm. I mean, are you feeling more confident or expanding, contracting? I mean, what, where are you right now?
Well, it's you know, I remember I thought after you write a first book, a first novel, it's probably easier to write the second one, and you might want to talk about that, but I don't know if... Maybe I just feel more in control of certain things, and maybe faster. I might go a little faster than I used to, you know, in terms of how... you get more skilled at certain things, but I mean, you have more experience. But about the fact that it feels every time like you, when you start a new book, it feels like you don't know anything. Coming back to Mr.
Right.
Beckett.
Well, I do feel that I don't know anything. Every time I start a new book, I've never written that book before, and I have to teach myself how to write it as I'm writing it, and so. Having written books in the past doesn't really help.
But you okay.
No, go ahead. No, it's just, I think the one thing that's happened over the years is that in the past, when I was younger, and I'd get to a passage in a book and I would get stuck, because it often happens when you're writing a novel, you just get lost. Then I would panic. I'd think, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to think my way around this problem. The whole book is falling to pieces. And I would really believe that. But now, when I get stuck, I feel less panicked. I'm calmer about it. I feel that if the book is meant to be written, I'm going to find a way to figure out this problem.
Right.
Yeah, that's it. Less
but
panicked.
I've heard you said that you know, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, and then the book is finished.
Well, it does seem that a moment comes where in the beginning, I'm stumbling around, and I don't know what I'm doing. And then a moment comes when I do know what I'm doing, and then it seems to come tumbling out, yeah, rushing forth. It's all very mysterious to me. Some books take a long time. Some books can be done in a shorter time, and it doesn't have anything to do with the quality of the work.
Right.
I mean, when you think that Kafka wrote The Trial in 6 weeks and Robert Musil spent 18 years writing Man Without Qualities and never finished, of course, it's much bigger, but still, there's no rules about time.
Right. Maybe it's about when you believe you're done.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when you get the feeling that
right.
the book is
right.
over.
Right.
So... Is the session?
I don't know. What time is it? Yeah. We've gone way past. So I guess we should take questions from the audience now.
Sorry. There was an abrupt ending.
Yes. But it's true. It's much later than I thought.
It's done, I think.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't know if the patients are cured. The session is done. What sort of tools do you use? Pens, pads, desks? Typewriter. I guess it's a question for either of you and both of you, since both of you probably use tools.
Céline first, what are your tools?
A hammer. I have a computer and I have notebooks. I take notes and then I write with the computer.
As for me, I always write by hand in notebooks. Either with a fountain pen or a mechanical pencil, depending on how confident I feel that day. And then I type up what I do on a manual typewriter. I know it's a very old-fashioned way to work, but I'm comfortable with it. And I don't particularly like working on computers. But now that you're required to give publishers a disc, I have someone type up the book for me on a computer at the end.
It makes me think when you bought a computer and you put it in your office and you said, The typewriter is not feeling well.
How do you construct a story from beginning to end? Do you have a stock of life experiences that you go to fill in bits and pieces?
Well, for me, I think it's the writing itself. It's the sentences. It's one sentence leading to the next one, that you know, and the way the writing sound. I mean, I have an idea of where I want to go, but it's really one sentence after the other, and they build the sentences, build the story, and push the story toward, you know, a certain direction.
I completely agree with you. I feel the same way. It's hard for me to begin a book without a sense of the trajectory of the story, but many details are lacking. And then I often get to a point where I'm about to use one of the ideas I had in my head, and I realize it wasn't very good, and then I have to just stop and rethink things. But I agree with Celine, it's the act of writing that creates the writing. And you can't know what's going to happen until you do it.
And that's part of the excitement, I imagine.
Yeah.
Or the despair.
It's not mathematics. It's really plunging into the unknown.
For you, Paul, could you talk about your exchanges with the artist, with the French artist Sophie Cal, that became a character of Leviathan?
Well, Sophie Cal is not a character in Leviathan. Some of her artworks are produced by one of the characters in Leviathan, so it should be made clear that Maria Turner and Sophie Cal are not at all the same person. Sophie, I met, it was many years ago now, and I was interested in her work and was asked by somebody, a film director named Michael Radford, a British film director. Some of you might know his work. He directed Il Postino, The Postman. That was his biggest success, and a lot of other films. And he wanted to make a film based on one of Sophie's projects, and he asked me to write the screenplay. And I had never heard of her before this. And so he and I cooked up an idea together, because I was quite interested in doing it at the time. This is about 20 years ago. And we never got anywhere with the project. But I got interested in this story I had made up. And so I used a bit of it in the novel, Leviathan. So, and with Sophie's permission, I used her, some of her works. Then she was fascinated by the works that Maria Turner does that she herself, Sophie, had not done. And so she went out and did those. And then she said to me, now that you've used me, I want you to write a story for me. And I'll do anything you want. I'll give you up to a year of my life to play out any instructions you give me. Well, I didn't want to do this at all. And I felt afraid, to tell you the truth, of the responsibility. Because Sophie's a great and unique person, but she's also a bit crazy. And if I told her to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, she would have done it. And so I resisted. For 2.5 years, I resisted. And every week she would call me from Paris, where's my story? Where's my story? And I said, well, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know. And finally, it got on my nerves to such a degree, I just wanted to get her off my back. And I sat down one afternoon, and in about an hour or 2 hours, I wrote down these simple little instructions about how to improve life in New York City. It's called Gotham Handbook. And wouldn't you know that one of the things I suggested was, take a spot in the city and take care of it. So she decided to take care of a telephone booth, a payphone. And she put flowers in it, she put notepads, cigarettes, food. She anchored a chair to the legs of the thing. And of course, it's a federal offense to tamper with a phone. And the FBI was looking for her just as the project was ending. So even this benign little idea almost landed her in jail. So we're still friends, Sophie and I, but I don't want to work with her anymore.
Another question for you, Paul. The thing I most like about your books is that the characters are not lovable. I wanted to know what you think about your characters' downsides, which in my opinion is their best side. I guess the question here is about failure.
Boy, I don't know. I find a lot of my characters very lovable, and I do love them all, I have to say. And I carry them around with me. I don't carry my books around in me so much, but I carry the characters around. And it's as if they're people I know. And sometimes they're failures. Most of the time, I suppose, they're failures in one sort or another. But everyone's a failure in the deepest sense of the word. I feel a kind of tenderness towards most of them that is as deep as the tenderness I feel for my own family.
Do you share that tenderness?
Yes, I think that the characters, but yes, I'd say the characters are close to me, but I wouldn't maybe think exactly like you do. They're not so clearly as, you know, I don't know if I have feelings for them. I don't know.
If you don't have feelings, what do you have for them?
Well, interest. Well, maybe that's a feeling. Okay, so
you're curious about them.
Yes, I'm curious about them. But I don't know if I love them or if I hate them. I don't really, you know, think about it in those terms. And they're kind of stuck in a book. So it's a little annoying.
Two questions came, wondering if or how religious you are. Mm.
For both of us?
you can each take one of those questions. How religious are you?
I don't practice any religion. I was raised a Jew. I went to Hebrew school. I had a bar mitzvah. I'm attached to the fact that I am a Jew, but not in a religious sense. It doesn't mean that I don't believe in spiritual questions very deeply, because I certainly know that men didn't create the universe. But this sense of adhering to the doctrines of any particular faith don't interest me at all. And so I guess I'm not a religious person.
Yes. Well, my grandparents were Catholics, but then, you know, my parents thought they didn't raise me with a specific religion, although I think that French culture is rooted in Catholic, you know, there we have it, even though it's there, even though we don't really acknowledge it. But then I don't have a religion in terms of the main religion, but I, you know, certainly have a form of faith in certain things, but they're very private and, you know, they're not dictated by any kind of religion.
Do you suffer from insomnia, Paul?
Sometimes, not habitually. Sometimes I find it very hard to go to bed. But I don't consider that insomnia. For me, insomnia is when you get into bed and you can't fall asleep. So sometimes I stay up too late, reading or watching a film. But generally, when I get into bed, I'm able to fall asleep fairly quickly. But there have been long, dark nights, I must say, when I haven't been able to sleep. And those are difficult times. And usually, one's thoughts turn to the darker elements of one's life, the darker elements of the universe. And this is what happens to my poor August Brill in this book.
You're poor?
Yes.
beautiful definition of insomnia in a French writer, Maurice Blanchot. He said that insomnia, the insomniac is someone who keeps the night company.
That's good.
Yes. Do you?
No, I sleep very well.
You sleep.
Because I have no problems.
it's totally apparent.
Right. No, well, no, I'm okay with sleep. Luckily, you know.
For you, Céline, what are the three novels that have most impressed you in the last year?
Oh, the last year?
2 years.
2 years. 10?
3 years. A decade.
Well, I read a book by a French novelist who is called Jean Echenoz, and that was called Ravel, and it's a novel about Maurice Ravel that I really thought was very good. Oh, that's a hard one. What else? Help me.
I don't know what you've been reading.
I don't know either.
Céline's been away. She spent six months in Japan recently, and then you've been in France. So
my memory is low.
I haven't talked to you much about your reading.
What have I read? I'm trying to be honest here and not make anything up. Well, I'm going to think about it. Maybe we get the next question.
Absolutely. And if you suffered from insomnia, you'd have an answer immediately.
Yes.
Paul, do you still translate, or was that just a useful occupation, something you did in your younger years?
I don't translate now, although in the book that I'm working on now, there is a translation of a poem, which I enjoy doing a great deal. I'm keeping my hand in, so to speak, but it's part of the story, and it's a Provençal poet, and I don't know Provençal, but I got a literal French translation of it, and so picked my way through it, and it's a poem by Bertrand de Born from around 1185, and it's quite a remarkable piece of work. But since that's the only thing I've done in many years as a translator.
Now that you are well-known and successful, what is your take on hand-to-mouth?
On hand-to-mouth? Well, I guess I think of it as a how-not-to book. Everyone's writing how-to books. And I think when I look back on how I went about my life as a young man wanting to be a writer, I think I did everything wrong. I was absolutely stupid. And the stubbornness that was in me is something that I find almost appalling right now. And yet, I'm lucky I got out of it. I'm lucky somehow those days ended at last. So they were difficult times, I have to say. And I don't forget them. They're very close to me still.
Céline, are you worried by the state of French culture today? The fact that there used to be the rayonnement de la France, France used to have this very strong cultural impact in a way, not unlike America, believed that it could civilize the world, but France today maybe doesn't have quite that standing anymore.
Well, what do you mean by French? Do you mean French artists? Or
French culture, French artists, the France for export, the France we read about. Today in the paper there was a piece about Guy Savoy, who wants the culinary arts in France to become something that belongs to our national heritage or to the French national heritage. Is that the same case with the French literature? Do we really know many French literary writers today the way we used to be able to invoke so
many? Well, as you say, it's cultural exports. I don't really like the... I mean, if you think about it in this way, you know, that it's just commercial, you know, export, you take certain things that are supposed to represent a culture, you know, and you export them to another country. And it's supposed to be, you know, a French novel, a French musician, But it's really a label. It's really the people who do the expert who will use when it's convenient or not, you know, the nationality of a person, you know, I think the way culture, you know, travels is much more diverse and cannot be stopped. It just happens with every person that, you know, travels to New York, every French person, and has a conversation. That can be considered as a cultural exchange. So I, you know, maybe the French government or French people are worried that their influence is decreasing, but...
Are you worried about it?
No, because I don't really think about myself as a necessarily French artist. I mean, I'm not in favor of labeling writers with their country of origin, maybe with their language, in the sense that this person writes in French, English, but not, you know, as a product of a country or, you know. I don't know if that answers the question, but...
I hope it answers the question. Paul, you once said that we live our lives in the company of ghosts. Do those ghosts, father, mother, friends, ever disappear? Do they, on the contrary, materialize?
They don't disappear, but they don't materialize either. That's the thing about ghosts. They stay ghosts, but they never leave you. And I think... And I guess I was trying to say that as you get older, more and more people that you've cared about in your life die. And once this happens again and again, and the losses accumulate, and then you're walking around with these people inside you. Because after all, how many people do you love in the course of a lifetime? Not that many, really. And when you lose a great number of them... They're still with you.
Does it have to do with the paucity of number of people you are able to love, or your ability to love many people?
It's just the fact. I mean, I guess Mickey Rooney was married 8 times. I suppose he was in love with all of those women at one time or another. But I don't think I've been in love with 8 women in my life. Fewer than that. And then there's the immediate family, and then some very close friends, and those are the people in the center of your life. There are people I like very much and care about, but I don't love them in the way I love the most important people.
In what way would you each say that your work is autobiographical?
Well. It's not autobiographical because I would say in what way it's not first, because it's not written as with the idea of writing an autobiography. That's not the point at all. So if there are things, I mean, there has to have things that come from my perception, maybe not from my life, maybe not from the facts of my life, but from the perception of certain experience or the emotions of certain experience. So, you know, certain situations that have, you know, marked me in an emotional way might somehow enter the story, but I'm not trying to find, to write about my life, so I don't... although some, you know, some of the things I might use are close to me, but it's not autobiographical.
In my case, I have written autobiographical works, nonfiction works, which I have talked about myself directly. In my novels, they're not autobiographical, and yet I have borrowed things that have happened to me. I think all novelists do this. Certain episodes in novels come directly from my own experience, always transformed in some way, but not repeatedly, and certainly not in every book. But occasionally, I'll draw on something. An example would be in The Locked Room, which is the third book of the New York trilogy, the narrator in 1970 goes through an experience working for the census in Harlem. Well, I did that. And so I based that passage on my own experiences. In the current book, Man in the Dark, there's a passage about the Newark riots of 1967. And I happen to be there and see them. And as things are described, it's pretty much what I experienced. Even though all the characters are different, everything is transformed, but the essential things I witnessed are accurate. But that's it.
Paul, what is your favorite word in the English language?
My favorite word in the English language? I used to have one. I'm not sure it still is. And it used to be murmur, because I liked the M-U-R-M-U-R. Murmur. Very, very beautiful word.
Has any word supplanted murmur?
No. Murmur remains number
Murmur's
one.
Murmur's very good.
But because also, now that we're, you know, talking to a French person, it also means wall in French, doesn't it?
oh. True. Mur. Do you have one?
No.
My favorite word in the English language is a word that one uses in French.
Which
and
is?
Very few people know its meaning in English. And I use it with relish. It's the word pusillanimous.
Pusillanimous, yes.
Fantastic. When he uses it in French, people in French know that pusillanime means
right.
lacking in courage. Mm-hmm. But
right.
you say this in America, and people are dumbfounded. Another word I very much like.
Dumbfounded.
Now, I've given you a lot of time, yeah. Céline. What are the two other books?
Oh, I forgot. Okay. Well, I thought about one, and...
You forgot?
It's No. It's Paul's wife's book. Siri Husvet, last novel, which I read. I read in the last
yeah.
year, and I thought was very good. And now you give me another 20 minutes, and I can think about the third one.
Well, come back in 20 minutes from now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.